Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The main team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Canuck Soldier.
Emperor Peter.
No one.
Rusty Edge.
Coming on the next episode of Polycast, should Canada be a civilization?
Yeah, once you open up that Pandora's box, then you got to open up Australia, friggin' Portugal, every other civ that's been slighted by not being in the game.
Atlantis.
Yes. Of course, you're listening to episode 112. I'm John Canuck Soldier Rider, and of course, we have our regular host, Dan Q.
It's getting shinier outside. Smile.
And we have Makula, who will be here shortly. I probably butchered that.
It was pretty close, though, but it is a Polycast tradition, so I actually would have been disappointed if you had pronounced it properly, so it's quite all right.
Yeah, maybe in another 20 guest hostings, I'll get it right. And we have Rusty Edge.
The unsweetened QNL substitute.
And Emperor Peter.
I'm just going to go with hi, everyone.
And then there's Gloria Condor 223 Carson.
Hey, this is no one. Well, after 6 years, Civilization 4 wins a Grammy for the Baba Yetu song. The gentleman, Christopher Tin, was the one who won the Grammy. I'm wondering why they're giving it for something that was released 6 years ago.
Well, if you notice in the article, it's talking that he just put out his first album called Calling All Dawns. This is the first time he's actually put an album out, and Baba Yetu was one of the songs he decided to include on it, which is why. As far as the Grammys were concerned, it didn't exist until now.
Yeah, it had to be on an album form, and I think it was released last year, wasn't it? So it was for the 2010 calendar year?
Yep, that's right, yeah.
Well, it was a rather nice surprise to find that he's done the nice work, and it's recognized. I was wondering if maybe he could be encouraged to do future work for Civ.
But will he be able to top Baba Yetu? I just don't know.
That's great. I love that. That was one of my favorites.
I know. It's kind of like if I wanted to do another internet show, I mean, how could I possibly top Polycast? I mean, it's Pete and, no? I think there's been some news in the Civ community about something that's coming up that a lot of Civilization V players have been looking forward to. I don't know. Does anybody know what this is? I don't know. I just heard a rumor about something, about things being changed in the game.
Why would they do such a thing?
Certainly not me. Talking about the February patch notes, we don't know what version number this is going to be for Civilization V, but it is to come out this month, sometime this month. And this was just posted a couple of days ago. There's no specific date in February, and seeing as how I'm going to have to post-produce this version and this episode will be released to the gaming public 1 week, here's an offer to you, 2K and Firaxis. Can you release this patch on the 27th or the 28th of February? If you do, I will give you 50 culture points. And I didn't mention that they were Civ 5 culture points specifically, but 50 culture points for whatever you want to do with them. Anyway, the February patch notes, Dennis Shirk, Civ 5 producer, says that they've been looking closely at the trade-offs between building a wide empire, one with lots of smaller cities sprawling across the map, as we have very much seen so far in the game, and a tall empire, one with just a few highly populous, highly productive cities. With this patch, you'll see a number of changes to the economic side of the game to bring these two playstyles in closer balance with each other. Further, we wanted to improve the effectiveness of buildings. We also wanted to improve how cities interact with the map. Adjustments to the terrain have increased production, while buildings that modify production have been adjusted in tune with these changes. You'll find that many buildings to be easier to build with extra benefits, especially if you've settled them near beneficial terrain and resources. We've continued to make improvements to pacing, diplomacy, turn times, the AI, and other aspects of the game. So what I've done here is I've gone through the patch notes, and I'm not certain exactly some of the ordering of these within the notes themselves. There seems to be a lot of reduction things. And as we're going through this, I tried to organize them by era when you would actually see them in the game, nitpicky that I am. But really, if I was to give this patch a name, I mean, it's going to have a number, right? I would call this patch Meat and Potatoes. I think the first one I'm just going to mention, I'm not sure there's really much to say about it, other than significant turn time improvements under engine. And I think we can all appreciate in single player and in multiplayer games, maybe even more so in multiplayer, it depends, how much time it takes in between turns. We sometimes find that we're able to complete our turn before the game is able to roll over to the next turn, particularly on larger maps as the game progresses. I don't know if other people have been experiencing similar things here.
And yes.
I'm certainly hoping that the intern optimizations help those people with, let's say, lower-end computers, especially in MP, and, consistent drops and stuff that probably result from that. One can hope, though.
And, I hear another voice. Hello, Mackie.
Maggie, who's that? Who's that? Where?
Well, welcome to the zoo.
And we were just commenting on the significant turn time improvements that we can look forward to.
I'll believe that when we actually play it.
Well, significant is a subjective term. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
Well, they certainly need to improve that. It's been glacial.
That's a good analogy.
Well, Civ does have a long and honored history of patching itself after release, so, and they've done a good job in the past, so let's have some hope.
Elsewhere in the patch, we're to enjoy user interface. Add combat summary when a city bombards a unit. Yeah, I like that. I'd like to know what the odds are here in terms of what type of damage I'm actually going to be able to inflict. It probably won't change whether or not I actually bombard something or the order necessarily, if I choose to. Okay, am I going to attack with my unit first, or am I going to bombard a unit first with a city? I mean, I usually would bombard it with the city first, but that would be nice to know.
And then the under that is denouncing, the new diplomatic status, denouncing that displays on the turn that an AI civ is denouncing the player. Gee whiz, I wonder what that means. Is it possibly a change of attitude? Is this meant to be a thermometer? You know, a heads up, you're starting to be in trouble, or what do you think that is going to mean?
Oh, wow. We wouldn't, we might not have to have a shrink added to the game to let us know what the AI is thinking about us and trying to interpret their wild mood swings.
Oh, so now when we go to the diplomacy screen, we're going to see a little thermometer, and the higher it is, the more likely they are about to attack you?
Yeah, either that or, or the thermometer of, you know, how much they like you personally. That's all. And similarly with that, denunciations and declarations of friendships, looking ahead at diplomatic AI, will expire after 50 turns. So I'm assuming then that after 50 turns, they could just turn around and denounce you again, but at least there is a defined beginning and end, and as Gloria mentioned, we're going to be able to see the interface itself, when that actually comes about, we'll get a notification and we'll get a turn reminder, so it'll be easier to make note of, okay, how many turns are left on this?
Well, that's a step forward from Civ 4, that you had diplomacy modifiers that never expired in 5,000 years.
Speaking of things that never expire, is there anything in here with our trade deals not expiring every 20 turns?
No, nothing about the trade deals in here, which maybe that might still be added to the patch. 2K Greg said there might be a few other things added still, but nothing significant. But it's kind of in the same vein, so hopefully.
Yeah, that's one of my biggest diplomacy things right now. So that is annoying to have to go back in every 20 turns. Your deal with so-and-so has expired. Your deal with so-and-so has expired. especially when it's a human. I don't want it to expire when it's a human.
What else? I guess since we're also talking about AI, we'll continue on this here. To me, we're talking about the meat right now, and then we get into the potatoes in terms of some of the more specifics that follow from this. There's also, I guess since we're talking about denunciations, avoid cascades of denunciations against a single player. AI now uses its own current friendliness level with a given power to determine how much weight to place on the denunciation against that power. Thank you?
Yay.
If I think you're the greatest person in the world, what? My neighbor thinks you're a jerk? Well, you know what? They're right, you are. What?
That's logical.
I also like some of the strategic AI thing in here. One is that AI calculation of enemy power now takes into account promotions. Ooh, I like that, and at the same time I'm thinking, I wonder to what extent the AI will be able to take into account promotions of the enemy, because we know as a human player we're not going to be able to see most likely every single unit and in turn what their promotions are, but I suppose the AI can use all the help it can get, because we're just that clever. And AI calculation of enemy might tweaked based on the size of enemy gold reserve. Okay, that brought a smile to my face.
Oh, hold on a second. I don't know if I like this AI calculation of enemy power to take into account promotions. So this means that if you save your promotions for later, you're actually weaker in the eyes of the AI. Am I correct?
And how does it count all of the healing promotions we take?
True, because that would just be something in one turn, instantaneous. There's no particular, there's not like a record on the unit that you have used instant heal X times. Maybe wouldn't take that into account. And Peter's question also is a good one too. I hadn't actually thought about that. I was just kind of, I had focused more on the enemy gold reserve, which I thought was actually, maybe that's the good thing, and maybe the account promotions is kind of the Mr. Spock eyebrows. I had to find some way to mention Star Trek in the show. It's a contractual requirement.
Please, AI, pay no attention to these offshore accounts I have.
I guess maybe the enemy gold reserve is when they think about, for instance, if we're going to declare war, or we're actually going to turn maybe a cold war into a hot war, like actually do some actual combat, then I could take into account that, if this civ has 2,000 gold, how many units could they buy in a turn? I know they'd have to also take into account the cities they have and what era it is, etc., etc., and then also the ability, you know, to get those units to wherever it is that they're needed, but still. And then, don't allow city-states to build the Manhattan Project. I just thought that was an urban legend, only because I never really get that far in the game, but that does seem kind of, that does seem kind of humorous.
I've had that, so, you know, you really have no control over when, all of a sudden the city-states have discovered the Manhattan Project, and wow, I'm not prepared for it, you know, when you have muskets and...
Nobody saw that one coming.
No. So it's going to be interesting. That's a good thing to take it out, because I've had a few times I've been surprised.
Bug fixes. Clear up cases where diplomatic status could show as friendly even after the AI power has denounced the player. Oh, I like that contradiction. What?
I liked it. I thought, you know, in Civ terms, Hitler and Stalin denounced each other while they had a pact of secrecy against Poland.
Say one thing while you're secretly doing something else?
Something else, yeah. I thought, hey, they're bringing diplomacy to a new level, but it didn't exactly work that way.
Because I know certainly the human player could play that way. Oh, certainly. Let's have a declaration of friendship, jerk. Confused AI says what? And also, fix situations where AI demeanor and verbiage didn't match friendliness level shown in the diplomatic status string. Well, now, to me, perhaps going into a particular diplomatic negotiation, let's say that they were friendly towards you, but maybe as the course of the conversation progresses, then maybe they're not so friendly anymore. Perhaps you're making an arrogant demand, for example, or perhaps they're annoyed with you going into it, but then you offer them some incredible deal, and then they're friendly.
Or they come begging for some freebie if you are not nice to them or recognize it. be nice to know how that affects it. If you decline to give them the goodie.
I like giving the AI freebies. Yes, I will give you a free takeover of your city for you. Sure. I'll do that this turn and next turn. And maybe the turn after that, I'll do it two for the price of one on a turn. So now to me, though, is again that kind of, I guess one other thing under the meat, as it were, Golden Ages now provide plus 20 cent production per city rather than plus one hammer per tile. That is of some significance, particularly earlier on, where, of course, the absolute values for production, culture, science, etc., are generally more valuable to you than percentage-wise, whereas, of course, as the game progresses, it's a little different. I still think Golden Ages are awesome, but it'll be interesting to see if they lose any of their shine.
Well, it may certainly encourage later era start to, you know, to get the bonus rather than everyone always playing ancient or classical.
I hadn't thought of that yet, John. I'm glad you pointed that out. I denounced this change, and I'm just kidding. I just am a later game start person. I again, part of my contractual requirements is to make fun of people who like later starts. You see, it's kind of like having, oh, but damn, he's Canadian. But his status is friendly, yet he just said this? Like, what's up with that? See? So I'm mimicking the behavior that we're talking about. Okay, anyway, maybe I'm overanalyzing this too much.
He's a rogue Canadian.
Oh, John, please don't report me to our intelligence agency.
Well, I don't know. I'll have to report you maybe to the language police or something instead then.
Oh, you're right. I got to be careful. A, what's this all about?
Yep, fail.
What? I'm meeting language requirements of Canadians. I'm catching up here. I didn't say it enough. Okay, a boot. A. There, I'm caught up. There are also a number of balance changes that go into some more specifics, and I will turn it to one or more of my fellow panelists to say, you know, is there something that you would like us to specifically start looking at, or even open it up to the people who are in the chat and listening to our Controlled Insanity? Which one or ones you would like us to go over first? I'll start with my fellow panelists. Where shall we start?
How about the tile spacing between cities? It might work well for a single player, but I see it as a problem for multiplayer.
More cooperative multiplayer than competitive multiplayer, I think. But yeah, there's... It's going to have to change how you're placing your cities big time. I still think it's, I mean, probably one of the reasons behind this, right, is to address infinite cities for all ICS. So, although my first reaction was kind of, sad face, I think it's also kind of like, just like my initial reaction when horsemen were nerfed, and I was like, oh, I have to start using swordsmen and longswordsmen more now, sad face. I think this is going to be a good change, though.
Yeah, not so much bombardment crossfire.
Oh, yeah, it's nothing like having that nice little matrix. I've seen some screenshots of those, like in the funny Civ 5 screenshots thread. Just how, oh, look at this, you know, this unit, good luck trying to ever get to this city because the other three or four cities around it can bombard you. And, oh, look at that, if you're not dead, you're completely ineffectual. Please give me an instant heal promotion. Please give me an instant promotion.
Yeah, I'm not sure it'll be so bad for multiplayer. I think it'll definitely mean a lot of people will have to rethink their ancient strategies there. But I think after a while they get used to it. It is, I think, a good ICS counter. And I think in the end, I think people will adjust. I think equally significant, though, would be the reduction in the core city tile. And people won't be able to... you know, do the early rush quite as much as well as not, you know, planting a city on every luxury within two tiles.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Let's see. What else on the patch list shall we highlight? There are so many things. We could probably have an entire episode on this patch.
How about the new building, the aqueduct?
Ah, the aqueduct. Yes, 40% of food is carried over after a new citizen is born, our entirely new building. I think it's kind of a continuation of further on to the granary, which is also getting changes in this patch with a reduced cost and a bonus one food for wheat, banana, or deer within the city. And Well, you know, they mentioned that they're trying to balance, Dennis mentioned that they're trying to balance the wide versus tall empire, give tall empires a greater chance. So the aqueduct is consistent with that. And even if you're thinking about a wide empire, I wouldn't exclude being able to build an aqueduct. I wonder if you need to build a granary first before you build an aqueduct. Wasn't that the way in some previous Civ titles? I think that would make sense to me.
It looks a lot like the granary from Civ 4, and remember, that was the best economic building in that game, so it's an important new building, I'd say.
People are money.
Money.
And science and culture.
More of all the good stuff.
I mean, I think it'll definitely help. I mean, really, there's no real reason to build a lot of buildings right now. If you can make your city larger with an aqueduct, then I think people will take that, you know, seriously considered anyway. I know a lot of people right now, all they do is they pump out settlers and then use their new cities to build some defensive or offensive armies and just keep going like that. The people that may not build very many buildings at all until they run out of space to plant cities, and then they go on the warpath.
I'm going to try my hand at a bit of a segue here. Usually the buildings that I end up building are happiness buildings because I've been expanding and people aren't as happy as they used to be. So with that in mind, a classical building, Colosseum, happiness reduced to 3 from 4, but also reduced the maintenance to 2 gold from 3. So, okay, to me that has impact. Maybe I'm not thinking on a large enough scale here, but I think that's a good change, but I don't know if I view that to be particularly significant.
Well, they reduced an awful lot of goodies from 2, 4, 6, 8, about 8 or 9 different items, reducing things or removing.
Well, yeah, over a larger empire, if you're thinking, okay, my 10 cities used to be able to give me 40 happiness if I added a Colosseum. Now it's only 30. Individually, it's not much, but yeah, over an extended empire, it can be greater. But
if you've got that big an empire, you might probably have enough natural luxury resources anyway.
Yes, either through inherently within your empire or through trade and or.
I don't know. I find that I never have enough happiness resources, so I think it could be a significant decrease. And also, the theater has reduced happiness now. It all adds up.
Yeah, so it's getting reduced to 4. It's 5 right now, isn't it?
I believe.
Yeah, it definitely might make people stop and, you know, build those happiness buildings rather than plowing out more settlers like they currently do.
Maybe that and have a few more roars rather than several, not necessarily several shorter ones, but kind of like, okay, a little bit of war, stop, take a breather to get more happiness buildings now in addition to just happiness buildings that we've got right now, get a chance to, I mean, really, I know being in the positive territory for happiness is beneficial towards a golden age. I mean, if you're on a roll though, what's more of concern to me in terms of, you know, when you want to be taking people out towards, say, the domination victory is when you start getting the penalty, when you get the 10 on happiness and you get the penalty to combat and production and that whole domino effect. Even though I am a warmonger, I don't mind the reduction in the happiness, at least in theory. It's been outlined here. Let's see what other interest of buildings here. Let's see. Market and bazaar providing 2 gold as well as plus 25% in the city, but. I tend to build markets only in, of course, right now, my larger cities, not only because of plus 25%, but they're more likely to be able to build them within a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, I still think buildings and units should be a little bit cheaper than they are. You know, in your, like you said, you're going to wait for your large cities to build those, even though they have maybe a better bonus to them now. It still takes quite a few hammers to build these buildings. You know, so you're making a choice. Do I build 3 more units or do I build a building?
And really, most of the building changes, just at adding them up here, really come at the medieval and later stages, just in terms of numbers of buildings that have been changed. And so just as an example, perhaps some of the more, maybe some more of the significant ones that are mostly in what they've been quote-unquote reduced to. Like, for example, an industrial era, the factory will now require a workshop, and it'll add 3 production as a base, but now it will boost overall production by 25% as opposed to 50. But at the same time, you also get one more great person specialist slot. You'll get 2 instead of 1, which, although I still think, because we're talking about later era, and then again, that the percentage being generally for any city that you're probably going to be building a factory again, those larger cities that can actually pump out a factory within a reasonable period of time, that you're very unlikely going to want to buy a factory. I think that it's significant that you're getting the production boost lowered to 25% from 50, if you make it that far in the game. What else is significance here? Maybe nothing in the buildings. You could look at, just briefly here, improvements and routes. There's quite a few on here, but I think the one that really struck me was trading post gold reduced from 2 to 1 increases back to 2 when hits economics. This could change the face of some early...
You mean we won't see trading post spam?
Yeah, well, a lot of people are going to be hurt by it, you know, no longer spamming trading posts, that's for sure.
Oh, no, I have to make an actual decision what to do with my tiles.
If I wanted to think, I'd be in real life right now. Come on.
Yeah.
So remember to finish your games where you did the trading post spam before you upload a new patch. Install a new patch.
Yeah, actually, you're mentioning that makes me think of a question that came up in the 2K forums, which was, once we apply the patch, are we going to be able to go back to our old saves?
Oh, it's yes.
And the question right now is, we're looking into that. We're hoping.
You guys.
But we're looking into that. So when it comes to getting a patch, for instance, that you would connect to the Steam server and automatically download. So I guess if someone really wanted to finish a game but still wanted to play Civ 5, I guess they just need to change their status to offline so they're not actually getting the latest patch. Is that
correct? Yes.
Yeah, you can go offline, or you can actually change the settings so that it doesn't automatically download. It's somewhere in the Steam settings. But, of course, you have to do that before you go online.
Being the tricky part there. If you have Steam on right now, you might want to change that.
What else would be of significance here? Let's see. Fishing boats, well, will now give 1 food and not gold, but then fishing boats will give 1 food with compass. Yay, I'm fine with that. I know that you're thinking, well, now gold might become a bit more of an issue with regards to the trading posts, but hey, I'm all for something that's going to give me more growth, especially early on in the game, and that's what I'm probably going to be plunking down the majority of it.
And why are camps on deer now going to get production instead of food?
That is definitely, that must be something towards gameplay balance. I'm not quite certain there, because it's certainly the realism thing is not there.
Yeah, if I have a hunting camp for deer, I'm going to get a lot more food than production.
Yeah, it must be a gameplay reason, but I don't remember reading anywhere in the forums people screaming for a change for deer, though.
Seriously, is there some tundra strategy we don't know about?
How's that
overpowered deer camp?
How's that going to affect Russia, who usually gets stuck up way out there with a lot of tundra and a lot of deer?
Oh, and how many more cities is the AI still going to stick up in the ice, even though there's no food?
Well, maybe they were listening to the Earth Map players who wanted something for the, you know, the Scandinavia and Russia. I'm not sure.
Lumber bale production increases by 1 from run with scientific method, and this was moved up from steam power. I'm glad to see that, simply because I admit, if I'm looking at a tile even later on in the game, unless it's, you know, like a tundra forest, which if I clear that, then I'm going to get kind of an immediate benefit, but on the long run, not so much. And maybe stop and think a little bit more, especially later on in the game, about keeping some of those forests. Maybe this is also to help with the later starts people. Oh, geez, Dan, don't start thinking that. You'll never stop ranting.
You're going to convert yourself at this rate.
What else? Oh, a production bonus from railroads reduced to 25%. What is that percentage right now? Is it 50? Maybe someone in the chat as well can help us out. Okay, it is 50%. Okay. Although I liked your original text of 505. Whoa, yeah, 505%. Woohoo. That definitely needs a patch.
So what Madgen is saying there in the chat is that between the 25% loss from railroads and 25% loss from factory, it's a massive production nerf. did we need a production nerf?
No.
Yeah.
If we're going to nerf something, I think we needed gold.
And remember the Golden Age production nerf.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to put things in Civ 5. What are you guys doing?
Yeah, that's the benefit that the Golden Ages can give you, but that's...
And with the trading post nerf, we'll have less money to buy things as well, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess we're going to be forced to build a lot of production buildings.
Which will now take longer because our production's getting nerfed.
Yeah, there's a bit of a catch-22 there.
Okay, we'll have to buy them then.
But that's also kind of, ooh.
But we don't have the trading post to do that.
Hi, this is the nerf stick. I think we just got hit with it.
We shall see. Where else? Oh, under resources, Marvel boosts Wonder Production by 20%, down from 25.
Yeah, let's get to policies, though, because holy crap, what did they do to Liberty? I mean, it's awesome, but I think this is going to be a little overpowered. Dan knows what I'm talking about.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Maggie.
Yeah, you totally didn't notice the free worker and the free settler with two of the different policies?
No, I did not notice that at all, Maggie. Thank you for letting me know.
Hi, Dan. So the GLaDOS is GLaDN.
See, Esther, I think we can see what they're trying to do here because ever since the game came out, there's always been this one is overpowered. Or the other ones, I also kind of like the reverse argument where people say that, no, this is underpowered. We should make the other branches just as powerful as some of the other ones. You know, you end up going either way. But yeah, quite a few changes under the policies.
They should make them all overpowered. At least it's consistent. And
that would be the Civ Rev approach. Make everything balanced by making everything overpowered.
I like that approach. It's more fun than the Civ 5, at least the Civ 5 approach to everything else, which is it's overpowered, nerf it to heck.
Well, that way we'll be in the modern era by 1000 BC. That's progress.
Yeah.
You want a moon landing in 1100 AD?
Well, this is about reimagining history, Maggie, not just recreating it, so, yeah.
We'll actually get into the modern era for one.
We know that settler cost has been increased by 25%, so, yeah, like collective rule, settler production increased by 50%, and a free settler appears near the capital. Kind of what we're getting at. Then citizenship, worker construction rate increased by 25%, and a free worker appears near the capital. This free unit X thing, I think that could... Dope.
This must be a liberty thing because there's also meritocracy, 0.5 happiness for each city connected to the capital, and a free great person of your choice appears near the capital. That's not going to get abused for great scientists like crazy.
Yeah, just tell us we have to get a great artist, and then we'll be like, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way to nerf it. Still give us something for free.
So they actually increased settler cost by 25% and then created a policy to decrease cost of settlers again.
It already did that before. Well, no, collectible? I think so, but it already had a settler reducing cost policy, but it didn't have the free words, free settler before.
Oh, okay.
No, and it was, yeah, it was initially, right, wasn't it, it was initially, all of your city's settler cost production was reduced, and then that was curtailed a little bit by restricting that benefit to your capital. So now we're going a little farther again.
Yeah, and that policy, collective rule, you can get that with just two. I think it's just two policy picks. So you're getting an extra settler that early in the game, or the free worker that early in the game. That's literally, it really is almost unbalancing, if it really isn't actually unbalancing.
I'm sure the devs will be looking at all the feedback and all the forums over the next few weeks. It'll take a while for us players to analyze the overall, you know, direction this patch is taking us, because there's a lot here, and there's a lot of changes, pretty huge changes in some cases.
Yeah, and in a bit of a, you know, treating each one of these policies in a vacuum, and we look at them, okay, this change in and of itself, and then, of course, we're often comparing that, understandably, to our gameplay experience so far, but then, okay, that, yes, there's this change, but then there's also this change and this change, like we've tied into about the reduction in the settler costs and then the policy change. And certainly there'll be even more feedback once that patch is released, because then we'll be able to see whether or not our analysis is consistent with regards to practice.
Yeah, it's hard to see how the whole entire dynamics of everything affecting each other will work out. And, of course, it'll also depend on each player's play style. Because, you know, with the game that Dan plays and the game that I play are two different things. And and this patch will affect them in different ways, too. But I'm sure that the devs will watch, and we might see more changes, maybe some back steps. You never know.
I thought there was a good, since we're talking about the patch overall here for a moment, I thought there was a good post from KB Biscuits on the 2K forums where he or she identified as having four main goals for this quote-unquote massive patch. Tweaking certain useless or cost inefficient buildings to become much more viable to choose as an option to build now. And then the second one is about the tall versus wide empire. Three, discouraging the final and dying remnants of a once vibrant ICS strategy and tweaking certain once not so worthy bonus resources to become much more beneficial, quote unquote. I don't know if it's going to, well, yes, it'll discourage the final and dying remnants of a once vibrant ICS strategy. It remains to be seen whether or not ICS will truly be dead. But I think what they're really, seems like they're really pushing here is to try to bring some of the balance to, in terms of going for a particular, victory condition other than, a domination. But at the same time, that seems to be what they seem to be doing when they're insisting on, you know, a lot of building changes and policy changes. Yet if we start looking at some of the other changes, like the reduction in the culture, for example, to the buildings that we mentioned, or the loss of some great people, particularly with like regards to great artists, for example, there seems to be some things that are actually working against strategies other than, domination. So it seems like almost all the victory conditions are taking a hit one way or another, only that may be more significant to anything but a domination victory because of how dominant a domination victory often is in single player or multiplayer. I was mentioned in the chat some good things that just we look at it and we say, yes, this is a good thing. And we've talked about, I think, some good things already. But, of course, our human nature is it makes much more interesting listening and discussion if we talk about things that we don't like. Well, let's put on a little bit of happy face for a moment and talk about how now the Colossus Wonder is no longer obsolete. Thank you. I might actually build it now.
And they added.
Colossus what?
Remember in Civ 4?
And they've changed Angkor Wat now, so you don't just get a 25% discount for the culture, but 25% discount on the gold costs to get plots. And they did a very similar thing to the Russian Skripos, because used to it was just culture, now it's culture and gold discount.
Yes, and the discount percentage for the culture is down. Like the Kripos, I think, is 50 right now, and now it's 25. And isn't with Angkor Wat, isn't it like 75% right now in every city? It's like, whoa.
It's a nerf, but they gave you both kinds. So if you put down a city and the city wasn't properly prioritizing to get to a tile that was, say, on your outermost ring that it could reach, this way either with culture it would get there fast, a little bit faster, or with gold, if you had it, since we still have some gold, even if it's going to be not as much with the trading post thing, but you can still buy out to it a little bit faster. But that's actually good with the Russian Krepos getting a little bit nerfed because, I mean, Catherine's borders go everywhere.
Overall, it seems that the response is pretty good about these changes.
Yes, the feedback has been generally positive to this point. Really, I think the common criticism is that this is great, but how come there's not more? And I think as part of the preface to the post from Greg Labs, the 2K community manager, from Dennis Shirk, Firaxis' Civ 5 producer, that they've already identified combat, multiplayer, late-game policies, wonders, and civilization-unique bonuses as additional areas that will benefit from this sort of attention. So the quote-unquote, so this is massive attention to the game on this particular patch, but based on that statement, we can expect similarly significant patches in the weeks or months to come that will address these particular areas. But I think that especially when you look at this particular list, it's a pretty massive undertaking that I know that I think a lot of people like these massive patches at once because it's like, okay, we're going to get all of this at once. But I think that if they tried to add any more, that they might be a little bit one step forward, two step back because you try to change too much at once, you may find that, oh, it would have been better to be a bit more incremental like they have been to this point. So they made clear what the focus is. You can debate whether or not they should have focused on something else, but hey, Fraxis and 2K are listening to community feedback. They're taking the suggestions into account. They're responding to concerns. So, you know, changes are not dead.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I think that's the best message. Whether you agree or disagree with the changes, it still shows that Fraxis and 2K is listening to the to its customers. And I think that in some minds that people thought that that wasn't the case. This should help alleviate that for sure.
I even saw one criticism that was, oh, this patch is nice, but you're stealing all these ideas from mods. Well, weren't some of the mods intended to address some of the concerns for the game, and now Fraxis at 2K are saying, good point, let's make it official so people don't actually have to get a mod in order to get this change.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with stealing good ideas if they're good ideas, you know. and making it an official patch makes Fraxis and 2K responsible for, you know, supporting the patch, whereas, you know, mods are just out there.
It also makes them responsible if people later decide that this improvement sucks.
That's why this isn't the end of the patch line.
Something that's missing from this patch is any enhancement to multiplayer.
Yeah.
Well, man, I want some more flexibility.
Well, the MP programmer still hasn't been hired yet. That ad is still on the Fraxis site. So realistically, I wouldn't expect to see a major core changes to multiplayer until you see that ad disappear. In fact, adding the DLC, I was pleasantly surprised that with their small remaining staff that they managed to code DLC and MP in there.
Yeah, we had the thing earlier up in the engine having significant turn time improvements, and I hope that's going to carry over to multiplayer, but I don't know.
Yeah, I'm hoping, too, that that'll help people. It's hard to tell whether the problems with the number of players in an MP game are related to the core or whether they're related to people playing with low or mid-range, you know, computers and, you know, and not responding in time. You know, there's no subjective way of determining that, but we'll see after this patch. If we think that, if there's a significant improvement, then we know that there's a lot of low-end computers out there.
Let's take up a collection for increasing the bait to get the network engineer hired.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I'll put them on my Christmas card list.
Yeah.
I'll contribute to that. I'll give you 100 culture points. What? No? Too much?
Yeah, those don't exist outside of the game.
I promise if they hire him, I won't kill him in a game.
There you go.
We'll kill you when you're testing for awesome code.
I won't kill you in the game. I'll just decimate you next to nothing and make you want to quit, but I won't kill you.
I won't take your capital, okay?
Oh, no, that's the point. You gotta attack another player. You're supposed to take their capital. It's their best city.
Did we get the Allied Maritime City Gates provide 3 food instead of 4 in the capital? I think that's a significant change. And many people did think Maritime City Gates were a bit too far. So it seems like a good change to me.
I'm sure we'll be readdressing this once people have a first-hand experience with the overall balance and have a little bit of judgment instead of just speculation. But, well, I'll let it at that.
What about removing city bombardment from empty cities? We can tie that into the patch, because it talked about how we're now going to be able to see a summary of what that's going to look like.
Yeah, and this thread is posted by Zenon, and he suggests to remove the city bombardment for empty cities. And he says, not only can you not take empty cities in Civ 5, you can also be damaged by that empty city. Why does Civ 5 allow cities with absolutely no military protection or basic walls / defenses bombard enemy units? Is it supposed to help against choking? Is it to encourage city spammers? I know you guys hate warmongers, but it's really ridiculous in the ancient and classical eras that you basically cannot take cities until you research ironworking and connected. In other words, this really forces players to spam cities. Farron will completely overwhelm the other player with his research / technology, gold, and production. Couple that with France, unless that player does the same. Why bother making wonders or units until ironworking? The warmonger is the counter to the spammer, but warmongers make war. And he suggests First, lower basic city defense, increase garrison city defense, and don't allow unguarded cities to bombard the enemy, and create happiness penalty for ungarrison cities. And he wonders if he's way off base here.
Yes.
This is one of my favorite changes in Civ 5 is the fact that I don't have to garrison every freaking city. So that if I'm busy making war on one side of the map, I'm not going to get sneak and have somebody just go plunk, 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 city, city, city on the other side of my empire. I was just so frustrating, and not the good kind of frustrating, in Civ 4. Maybe it should be reduced if there's no garrison, or increased if there's a garrison, you know, either way. But I'm completely gone? No. No, 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 no. Anybody who's had barbarians pop up on them in the first 50-100 turns of the games knows why that is a bad thing. Do you really want to have your city conquered by barbarians in, like, 5 AD, but, like, in 3000 BC?
Only when I'm feeling masochistic.
Exactly.
I think the thread is a little misnamed. I think by the end of the thread, the real issue is, you know, the cost of plunking down cities, and the fact that garrison melee units don't do anything for your defense. And I think he's got some that Xenon's got some valid points as far as that. I especially think that if I have a unit in there, it should add to the defense somehow. You know, otherwise, you know, yeah, an archer is okay because you can bombard with it. But a spear in my city is useless. If it's going to die, the spear's dying with it for no good reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the spearmen can't put down their spears and go to the wall and start helping people wind up a catapult or pour boiling oil over the wall. You know, come on. Yeah. There are plenty of things the melee unit could do realistically, yes, running around the city.
Also, it's just more manpower.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that could definitely be a change, that if you have a unit in there, you know, maybe it adds, 10% to the defense value, and it takes one more turn to take it. At least then you're getting something for the hammers you put into the spear.
Yeah, a little bit of a bonus buff would be better than taking that out completely, because then that leaves you open to barbs at the beginning, and that's just,
It should be hard to take, I think. It never was easy. Even more so in ancient and classical eras, when there wasn't much siege equipment available.
Well, that also reflects back to the one-tile cities. If you can't get units out there to protect it, it'd be rather difficult to defend it. So I like the way it is.
Yeah, and the third title about, you know, empty cities. Well, the city's not empty. There are people there. It's
you could assume there is a sort of militia.
Yes, I mean, that's how I've always, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, the city bombard is the militia attacking. Maybe that's actually an actual ranged combat, like it's represented in the game, but maybe it's something else than that. Maybe it's a little more, you know, hand-to-hand.
And hey, maybe early on the bombardment isn't anything fancy, but it's just everybody climbs up on the roof with a pile of rock and starts chunking at things. You know, it is still defense.
Yeah, I think the only point he was trying to make is that if you do the math, it's less expensive to plunk cities down right now than it is to build units to take a city. So you got a better chance of just plunking cities. Oh, if you lose one, it's cheaper to make a new one than it is to defend it. And I think he's got a little bit of a valid point there in terms of the math of the situation.
Yeah, but that's a balance issue.
Yes, I agree. It is a balance.
The cost of the settlers and the soldiers.
And as Imagine points out in the chat, to actually also tie it to our upcoming patch, what this could mean post-patch, I give you a cheat code of the oligarchy path, where garrison units cost no maintenance, and cities with a garrison gain plus 100% ranged combat strength. There's a reason to garrison.
Sure.
And that's good, and I think that the argument of the discussion almost becomes more about should you garrison or should you not garrison, for example, as opposed to let's get rid of city bombard. Because I too join the chorus of thank you for having that in there, because it can mean the difference between a barbarian brute taking a city and your ability to either quickly build or quickly buy if really needed, or quickly move a unit back in order to be able to take the barbarian out. I mean, yes, the city bombardment has benefit later on in the game beyond the, you know, initial barbarian consideration, but that's what I think of in terms of city bombard, is to just kind of get them to, if they actually are thinking about attacking that turn or the next turn or something like that, you know, give them a better chance for the city to not even just survive, of course, because, you know, even if the unit actually does attack, the city itself has strength in addition to the ability to bombard the city. So the fact actually tying in the patch, because there's that, the fact that if you actually garrison a unit in there, then you get, you know, additional range strength, hey, it's all good to go. A feature we're trying to introduce this year is just to talk about a focus on a particular Civ community, and seeing as how we actually have someone as a guest on this episode who has something to do, maybe tangentially, with one of these sites, we figured, what the heck, it'll kill some time. No, I'm just again, John Canuck, soldier writer, who is also the administrator of Civ Players, the Civ Players League, which I think has been around for about a decade now, right?
Yeah, we started up just shortly after Civ 3 Play the World came out, so 9.5 years or so.
So, John, what can you tell us about the Civ Player League?
Basically, like anyone knows, when they have entered any of the Civ game lobbies and go to play a game, it's basically a free-for-all. And people tend to quit these games as soon as they see a couple swords show up at their city. And, you know, a lot of people like to think that playing MP is, you know, like playing single-player. And that's not the way it is, really. So a friend of mine called Warning U2 decided that we need to do something about this. And so he created the first version of Civ Players, and we went from there. We progressed through the Civ 3 Conquest. When Conquest came out, we actually had the first beta testers from the MP world. And, you know, there was some growing pains with that because it had never happened before. You know, no one had ever come along and said, look, there is an MP world. There's people who want to play this game in MP, and we're not just like the AI. That brought us into a lot of the very esteemed single-player sites like Apollonian and Civ Fanatics and all the other niche sites had never heard of us in a lot of the key players until then. So since then, we've built ourselves a lot of build bridges. I believe strongly in building bridges with all the entire Civ community. And I think we've come to a point now where we've coded our own site from scratch. My co-owner, Scott Death to All Forum, he's done a really good job in coding our new site, and we're still working on, you know, expanding it, just, you know, like most sites do. And, you know, we actually were listed on the 2K fan site list without having to ask them when Civ 5 came out for the first time. So I think we've garnered more of a place in the fan site world lately.
You recently finished a Civ 5 cash kickoff contest, and I guess you have another contest that's going on right now. Is someone an example of the involvement of some of the members of your community and the commitment to it, putting money where their keyboards are, actually donated, is going to donate some money for a contest that you're running in some players?
Yeah, we've actually had in the past quite a few donors, like, you know, most sites do. For the most part in the past, they've wanted to remain anonymous. You know, like, you know, here's a couple $100 to pay the rent sort of thing, because we really appreciate what you guys are doing, and we know you put a lot of your free time into this, and they just donate the cash behind the scenes. Lately, yes, we've had people that have gone out and said, look, I want to help with the launch of Civ 5, and I'm willing to donate some of my cash to run a contest, you know, in order to attract, you know, more players, you know, give that little, you know, kick in the butt to get it going. And that seems to be catching on. We had our cash kickoff contest. It just finished a few weeks ago, and we've handed out the money. And I can say that while not everyone cares about a couple $100, it definitely did put a little icing on the cake for some people. And yes, we've had another member who wants to put some cash in for a Civ 4 tournament coming up. I think he's picked his birth date in November as the day he wants to do that. And, yeah, we're quite happy to entertain those things.
From Colonel Mustard, what's CCC or Triple C, and what's the level of play that comes with that?
I'll answer the first question that's easiest. The CCC is the Clan Championship Cup. Basically, what happened as we evolved is we started out as just offering a ranking for random lobby games. So anyone could join our league, play little random lobby games, and then afterwards the winner would report them. Everyone gets ranked. You gain and lose skill, etc. And then after a while, people decided to form clans, which is actually a very good thing for the MP community. Clans form probably the core of the, for lack of a better term, elite players, or players, you know, far above the bell curve. And those organizations, we don't really regulate them and how they play or anything, but we support them existing, and we offer this Clan Championship Cup approximately once every 6 weeks, where all the clans get together and they bash each other into non-existence for a weekend. The good thing about it is that these clans with their elite players are there, and they show new players that there's something to do, something to stretch for. You know, I'm not very good, but those guys are very good. If they let me into their clan, they're going to train me, and I'm going to get better, and we all enjoy these weekends.
If someone wants to get involved in Civ Players, what would be your recommendation?
Everyone starts out as a new player or as a noob in slang, and there's really no better way of learning than just jumping in and playing. And in Civ 5, because there's no open lobby like in past games, which is unfortunate, we operate a Steam chat, and we operate that for everyone. Whether you want to join the league or not, you can come and use our Steam chat to find games. A lot of our league players will even play open games just to attract new players or show people that the difference is an MP and how much fun it can be. Give it a shot.
All right. Well, thank you, John. And again, that address for Civ Players League is over at civplayers.com.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Peter?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. You didn't want the show to end. I understand.
Yeah, that was it. You've been listening to Polycast episode 112. With you were Douglas Rusty Edge Smith.
It's been a pleasure live.
John Canuck Soldier Ryder.
It's been a pleasure again.
Gloria Carson.
Yeah, this is Nolan. It's been fun again.
And McAlua. I think I pronounced it right.
Yes, for once. Someone gets it right. Yes. I'm going to be off in search of caffeine now. Thanks.
Stop sucking up.
And last, but Daniel.
Life is a highway, and so is Civ. I want to ride it all night long.
It'll cost you.
is it a toll?
Is that your best tagline?
One more turn. Insanity.
One more turn, Dan.
Is this where I'm supposed to read?
Yes.
All right. Over at Pauly Town. It's the Polton, I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's just like with Mac, you can just say Pauly, and then you're always good to go.
I'm speaking very hard about that.
I guess maybe we've...
Topic dead.
Topic dead.
Yeah, I guess we've exhausted.
I think perhaps we may have a caller in here, as it were, and for some reason, that's the window I closed, was the chat window. Oops.
Good job, Dan.
Ah, crap.
Record date, February 19th, 2011. Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.